From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the winter of early 2009, in the very first days of the Obama administration. And just months before, outgoing President George W. Bush had to decide if the big three automakers needed the government's help to survive. President Bush ended up going against the wishes of many of his fellow Republicans and taking the first steps toward a government assistance of Detroit. Well, now President Obama had to decide how much help the government could and should provide. His administration helped structure an assistance program that included a plan to eventually recover taxpayers' money. The president explained that we were in extraordinary circumstances with an industry that employed hundreds of thousands of people, and so the federal government went forward with the so-called bailout, helping the automakers survive. Yes, General Motors endured the derisive nickname Government Motors for a while, but the company resolved to produce a better fleet, the kind of cars that people wanted to buy. Over the last 5 years, the government has sold off the shares it held in GM, finally fully divesting in December. So now the government is out of the business with GM, and it's time to look fully at what worked and what didn't quite pan out. We're going to hear from some conservative critics. We want to hear from you this hour, 263-9994, 263-WXXI. What do you think of when you think of the term auto bailout? Is that a fair term? Has it gone well? And joining us in studio is Dan Maloney, who is the president of UAW Local 1097. Dan, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Jerry Burge is here as well. Jerry is the shop chairman of Local 1097.
Thank you.
And I would never invite these guys without inviting some of the critics of the ostensible bailout from the other side. And unfortunately, the Cato Institute canceled on us today, along with the Center for Legal and Policy Analysis in Philadelphia. They've been critical. They also canceled with us. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to be reading some of their comments at length. We'll let our guests respond. I also have some sound bites that we'll get to that will help us understand some of the opposition, even to this day, to the bailout. And then we'll try to look at the numbers and understand what's actually happening. So first of all, Dan, you told me you don't even like the word bailout, do you?
No.
Well, what was it?
Restructuring and loans, right, granted to the auto industry. And it was necessary, right, to keep the entire manufacturing base of the U.S. vital segment of our economy going. And it was well done. This is actually, I think, a model going forward if we ever run into trouble again. You know, other countries and other economies support their manufacturing base at the expense of U.S. workers and U.S. taxpayers. So it was about time something was done right. And the effects, if we were allowed to go bankrupt, as some of these conservative groups were calling for, would have been devastating to the U.S. economy. It would have been devastating to the U.S. economy, and we are the we buy everything from the world, right? China, Europe. So as we go under, the world economy would have suffered. We would have been into a Great Depression. So when you look at it globally, it was the right thing to do, and both administrations, Bush and Obama administrations, thought that as well. And some a lot smarter people than me and Jerry into economics thought the same thing. That's why these loans happened.
So we're going to be looking at the numbers throughout this hour, and we're going to do our best to get into the numbers and understand exactly where we are 5 years after the auto bailout. Again, you can join the conversation at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And we're also going to have a chance to hear from some of those conservative critics who say, accurately as Dan says, that their concern was not that it might not work. The concern most often was that this was anti-competitive, Dan. Mm-hmm. That let's say you're an automaker who's not one of the companies in need. When the government stepped in to help GM and the others, the automakers who were doing well, who didn't need assistance, were going to be negatively impacted, that it would hurt their sales, it would hurt their employment, because you're anti-competitively getting into the market and the government's choosing winners and losers.
Right, and that's a fallacy. Due to our connected supply chain, and that's why you saw Ford, who pretty much thumps their chest that they didn't need the government cheese, right? You saw Ford at those congressional hearings telling them that there was a need to give this loan to the auto industry. In the report that I've been working off here, the Center for Automotive Research, you'll see the supply chain among the foreign transplants in the U.S., as well as the Detroit 3, were about 70 to 80% interwoven. So, in other words, if GM and Chrysler were allowed to fail, right, the price of brakes, exhaust, wiring harnesses, radios, etc., would have went through the roof. And remember where the economy was at that time in 2009, just coming out of the mortgage crisis, the banking crisis. There was no credit available for folks. believe me, if the price of those supply parts went up, those suppliers would have went under. If they went under, Ford would have went under, Toyota, Honda, etc. Again, it would have snowballed globally. So it was the right thing to do.
Let's listen to, if we could, let's listen to Peter Schiff. Peter Schiff was, he manages a financial company, but also was an economic advisor for candidate Ron Paul in 2008. And Peter Schiff was asked at the time, what is the best course of action? Should the government be getting involved? And his comment here represents a lot of what the criticism has been then and still is today. Let's listen.
I think letting them go under is the best thing for the U.S. economy and for the auto industry. You know, we need to allow these companies to fail. Forget about the constitutionality of these bailouts, but the government needs to let GM or Ford or Chrysler fail if that's what has to happen, because we need an automobile industry in this country, but not this one. We need a competitive automobile industry. We need new management. If these companies go into bankruptcy, all the plant and equipment is still going to be here. It's just going to go under new management. These companies need to get out from under these labor contracts, these pension obligations, this health care expenditure. We need an efficient, vibrant automobile manufacturing industry, and we'll get one if these companies are allowed to fail.
Okay, so again, he's wrong. I mean, there's no other way to say it. Had we been allowed to go belly up, right, myself, and I believe it, the numbers that we have from this car report would have been 2.6 million Americans. Again, it wasn't just the direct auto industry. It was the supply chain, which goes into mining, right? Glass, steel, rubber, and again, the wiring harnesses, the computer chips, the whole thing, research, development, engineering. So everybody would have been hurting at a time when this economy was so fragile, right, that our mortgages would have went into that toxic mortgage debt pool. And we would have been drawing from government assistance on unemployment, food stamps, etc., rather than earning a paycheck and putting into the tax base. So that is certainly a fallacy that you just heard.
Give me a sense, Dan, for, and by the way, if you're joining us today, it's a Wednesday afternoon at 1 p.m. on Wednesday in our hour for our city residents. You can watch on City 12 if you're a Time Warner Cable customer. So Dan Maloney here, Jerry Burge from Local 1097 and the UAW are here talking about the auto bailout. And Jerry, let me ask you, when you hear the term bailout, don't worry, we're going to make Dan do most of the talking this hour. But, you know, taxpayers do want to know if they're getting a good deal. What's your general sense for when people use the term bailout and when you talk to people, how people view the bailout?
I would guess you hear bailout and you feel that somebody's just giving you something and you don't have to give back from it. We got loans. You know, they got the company gave the government stock. The government sold the stock back out. So they got a good share of their money back from that. The loans are all been paid off. So where's the bailout? You know, it was helping hand when it needed to be given.
There's going to be a lot of ways to calculate the money side of this, Dan, and I'm going to do my best to be fair and to look at all the numbers. The rough estimate of the overall bailout of the three companies was $80 billion, about 50 for GM. Fair?
Correct.
Fair? Okay.
Fair enough.
Okay. And the government, after doing so, owned, I believe, 61% of the shares of GM, slowly started divesting, and then this past December sold the rest of them. So they're out of the GM business now.
Correct.
They would have had to sell the stock, the remaining shares in December, for about $52 a share to get back to even. The share price ended up being in the mid-30s when they sold. So they recovered roughly 80% of the GM loan, $40 billion or so instead of the 50 that was used. So that's a negative. That's a net loss just on the loan of $10 billion. Then you look at the question of, did it save jobs? Did it then save tax revenue? Did it save the companies in a ways that obviously saves the government money elsewhere? Does that $10 billion get made up in the wash there? Do you think it does?
Yeah, money well invested. And the deal is, again, the Center for Automotive Research study shows it saved $285 billion in personal income in 2009, 2010, and $40 billion in tax revenues, $40 billion in tax revenues that would not have been there. So deduct the 10. Go ahead and deduct that $10 billion that people are claiming we lost. You're still up $30 billion. It's a multiple of hundreds. if you could get a Wall Street banker to give me that kind of return on investment, you know, that guy's going to the top.
And then the overall, when you look at outside of GM, the other two companies, the overall, again, the net loss just on the loan, and to Dan's point, there are other ways, other factors we have to consider, but just on the loan, the estimate now is, according to Reuters, here's the Reuters report, Treasury now estimating that the 2009 bailout will eventually cost the government roughly $25.1 billion. But again, far short of what Dan, what you're saying that we made back. So you're saying, okay, down $25 billion, worth it.
Yeah, they're only looking at one side of the ledger, right, what they spent. What about the cost avoidance, right? They never look at that. What would have been the consequences of people losing their homes on unemployment, not putting into the tax base, taking out of the tax base, right? They always fail to look at that. The other big one on that, and we've just been through it, we were Delphi, rolled into Delphi, rolled back into General Motors. Delphi went bankrupt. GM went bankrupt. So our membership at this plant and hourly and salaried folks both have been through the devastating bankruptcies. And most of the folks in our plant lost pay, benefits, and pension, right? So the pensions went into this government PBGC, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. So the study goes on to show, had the auto industry been allowed to go under, the PBGC would have been overwhelmed. So all those retirees out there, and in particular, the study cites Florida and Arizona, 600,000 auto workers living in these southern states, right? They would have lost their benefit, would have went bankrupt. In those states, it would have been catastrophic, right? And these are typically Republican-leaning conservative states. They would have been hurt from this, devastated.
5 years after the auto loans, according to the UAW, bailout, according to the critics, we're asking whether it was a good idea, whether it has worked, and whether it should be a model for future government action. In studio for the hour is Dan Maloney and Jerry Burge, both with Local 1097 of the UAW, and we want to get to the phones as well here. Mike in Brighton, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, I just wanted to say I'm a small business person, and it certainly doesn't take a lot to figure out that this had to be one of the best things that the government did in 2009. Again, I'm far from pro-union, but it's clear that if $10 billion was all we lost, quote-unquote, with the GM deal, $10 billion we're easily spending in Iraq and Afghanistan in a month. And, you know, nobody's looking at that and saying that that was a complete waste of money, although some people probably do. But, it's so unimaginable that anyone would even question as to whether this kind of action by the government at that time was anything but the right thing to do. I think you got to go pretty far, even into the most conservative business ranks, to find people who are, in the end, critical of what needed to be done at that time.
Go ahead, Dan. Want to respond to that?
Yeah.
And thanks for the call, Mike.
Absolutely. And you're seeing this in the Ukraine, right, where John Kerry's already offered $1 billion in assistance overnight without a blink of an eye. You saw the bailouts for the banks, right? They weren't loans to the banks. That was a gift from the taxpayer to these people who knowingly put us into a bad situation in 08. So it was certainly the right thing to do. The other part of it is R&D, right? We talked about the supply chain, but research and development and patents. The auto industry is a leader, right, in patents, has been for years. All kinds of inventions come out of there. And if we weren't allowed to have those centers of research here in the U.S., if they went over to China, for example, believe me, then all the future jobs, all those future inventions are going to be made in Asia, right? And we'd be a third world country. We all know that. It's staying up on cutting edge technology, and the only way to do that is through manufacturing. So that's been proven. And the other point that we always touch on is the ability to build tanks, planes, weapon systems that defend our way of life. We know from World War II how the auto industry was able to convert, right, from consumer products over to wartime products. If there is no manufacturing base left in the U.S., that would be devastating for our national defense as well.
Let's get to Gary in Rochester. Gary, thanks for calling Connections.
Having two good shows today. You know, in regards to this issue, one of the things your predecessor would always say is follow the money. And I'm wondering, maybe you could have a short discussion on who funds the Cato Institute and who funds the UAW. And you can see which one, you know, we could decide which one, the motives we want to follow. I think one of the things that is lost in this discussion is we can sit back and we can crunch numbers. And we can say it costs this and it costs that. But one of the things, and I'm glad that unions are here and they're standing up for people, is the cost that the Cato Institute and the conservatives always fail to add in is human suffering. You know, an ethos of our northern neighbors, Canada, is that when a Canadian falls, Canada is there to pick them up. I would suggest the unions do that for America, that when an American falls, America is for them to pick up. And I don't know if I missed it, but if Dan could talk about, you know, Ron Paul and others talk about this being welfare and we have to let these fail. But if you could talk about NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Pact and the corporate welfare and the bailouts that corporations get, at a different level that help these conservatives, I wonder if you could address that also. Thanks.
Gary, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Dan.
Sure. There's a great article in the Democrat and Chronicle this weekend stating how most of those economic development dollars have gone to a couple of large corporations, one of them being the Koch brothers. And right here, I believe it was IBM in New York State. But you look no further than Monroe County IDAs, right? And I know I live in Greece, and when Walmart was going to move in, you know, the Walton family, they're all billionaires. They had their hand out. They needed money from the county taxpayers to build a store. You know, these people that are free market capitalists, they're the first ones with hat in hand begging for the money. So, you know, and I don't understand it, how that went through. We were in opposition to that type of corporate welfare. If you have a good business model, you have a product or service to offer, you should do that. And you shouldn't be looking to get into my wallet. But they do, and they did. And then they pay their workers minimum wage, part-time labor. And so guess who bails out those workers with food stamps, housing allotments, etc.? It's the taxpayer again. So that Walmart or megastore model doesn't work for America, and that's corporate welfare at its worst. And but again, this one worked. The loans were repaid. And we have those centers of manufacturing in the United States and the Center of Research and Development for those future jobs still here.
263-WXXI, 263-9994, Dan Maloney and Jerry Burge from UAW are with us talking about 5 years since the government's intervention in the auto industry. Did it work out the way it was intended? We invited the Cato Institute and other groups to come out and talk about some of the criticisms. They've had to cancel, but I am going to be trying to address their points as well. And we'd love to hear from you. We're not here to, certainly as the host, not to choose sides, but to try to examine all angles of the issue. And here's one, Dan and Jerry, that I heard addressed this morning. I contacted an economist who works for a nonpartisan review center that I know well. And I said, you know, I know you haven't personally studied the auto bailouts, but give me a sense for the view in the community of economists. Have they worked out the way they were intended, positive or negative? And he said, I will grudgingly tell you that it appears to have been a good investment. And I said, why grudgingly? And he said, because of moral hazard, that when you have large companies, whether it's a bank or auto industry, that knows that it will not fail and the government will step in, that we're creating a system where they are going to put themselves and their workers at risk time and time again, and eventually it may not be the government stepping in to save them. Have we created moral hazard here, Dan, by saying to companies, hey, we're not going to let you fall? Shouldn't you be allowed to fail?
You know, I would agree with that in the service sector. Again, I think the manufacturing sector was too important. They talked about these banks being too big to fail, that it would have rippled through the economy and created the Great Depression all over again. I believe that's true, certainly of the auto industry, which is the linchpin of manufacturing in the United States. And again, when you look at it, mining and steel and all the R&D, all the electronics, you know, I've been on this show before with your predecessor about the hydrogen fuel cell vehicles that are coming, clean energy, and that was refined right here in Rochester, New York, by our engineering staff. If we were allowed to fail, that wouldn't be here today. Again, I'd love to talk about some of our local stuff that we've been going on here.
Well, and we're going to find out because we often talk about Detroit.
Yes.
We often talk about this 5 years ago as if the government stepped in because only Detroit was impacted. We're going to talk about the local impact, but let's get to another caller who's been waiting, and that's Harry in Rochester. Go ahead, Harry.
Yeah, just a quick question. What about the original investors in GM, the ones who lost everything? You might have got your bailout or your loan, whatever you call it, but literally you wiped out a lot of people's savings, pensions, et cetera, that way.
Dan, how would you respond to that?
That's fair. And by the way, workers are shareholders too, right? And we all suffered. And again, not just the shares of stock that we may or may not have owned, the cut in pay that we took, the cut in benefits. We all, you know how they say it on TV, we all took a haircut. It was painful but necessary to get this giant industry back on its feet for the good of the nation.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, as part of the bailout loan, the union took an equity stake in it and sold out at a good rate as well. So really, the union didn't lose.
Well, our members on the floor that are down $10 an hour from where they used to be and no longer have a pension would beg to differ, Harry. But certainly we all put some something into the pot here to keep this thing going, and I hope it goes for future generations.
Well, we can agree or disagree, but you made a very good hourly rate and drove it in a direction that didn't help it to be a success.
To Harry's point, and Harry, thanks for the call. To Harry's point, Dan, there's a lot of criticism that says whether it's UAW, unions elsewhere, you've got to be able to step back and agree to either reduced hourly rates or a change in pension or benefits. Number one, is it fair to say that you think that the UAW made a compromise in this case during the government's intervention? And number two, are we going to see unions in the future be more willing to give a little in that way?
I think we always have been, but of course our mission is to better our workforce, right? The members that we represent, we want to get them the best benefit package and wage package we can.
But not if it's going to collapse the company, right?
Obviously, if the company's not there, right, nobody's earning a living. So that's since the bankruptcies, it used to be a more adversarial between the union and management ranks. And lately, you'll see a lot more folks working together because we have to for our mutual benefit. There was a lack of trust. Right. In the past, management wouldn't share a lot of numbers with union guys because we would ask them for a certain benefit package. We can't do that. Okay, show us the numbers. They were unwilling to do that. Nowadays, they're willing to open the books freely. We can see and make intelligent decisions with management at the bargaining table, and we do. And, there's been this ongoing debate about raising minimum wage. Had it been allowed to float with the cost of living since 1968 base year, it would be somewhere around $12 an hour now.
Right, that's so, right. Roughly 11-something, but that's right.
I don't think it's a lot to ask that a manufacturing person that's, I mean, we can't be a minute late, as Jerry will tell you, because that line's running. And we got to build that, and we do, the highest quality fuel systems in the world in our plant here in Rochester.
Would you take the minimum wage to 11 or 12 bucks overnight?
You know what it should be? Anybody that works 40 hours in this country shouldn't need to be on public assistance. That's where I would put it, whatever that takes. And again, stop giving the welfare to the corporate guys, to the Walton family, right?
Let's
distribute
that.
The wealth a little
I certainly
better.
Understand that argument. Do you accept that if the minimum wage goes to $11 or $12, certainly the workers who make that will do better. They'll be in a stronger position. But there is some non-zero number, and we don't know what it is, but it's not zero, of people who will lose their jobs as a result. Do you accept that?
I'm saying no, because every dollar you give at the lower scale, right, income scale, is spent. It's not hoarded in an offshore bank account like wealthy people do. They spend it, and it creates jobs, and there's been studies done on that.
But we know economists say there some people will lose their jobs because some companies will say, we'll employ you at $9 an hour but not 10, or we can employ 8 but not 10 at $10 an hour, that kind of a thing.
Again, it'll be offset by consumer spending, which is 2/3 of GDP in the U.S.
Okay. So. Dan Maloney is here from the UAW. We're talking about the auto bailouts from 5 years ago. Again, he calls it the auto loans, and fair enough. We'll call it the government intervention from 5 years ago. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a short break here, come right back, and we're going to look at the jobs saved number and try to get a real handle on how many jobs were saved. Is it possible to know what was the average cost per job. We think we can start to do that now, and we're going to do that next with Dan Maloney and Jerry Burge right here on Connections on member-supported public radio. All right, welcome back on this Wednesday afternoon. I'm going to give our intern, Nicole, a job here. Look at you. Look at your eyes get big. Nicole's in the room here. She's had never had her name mentioned on the radio, but she's doing this great work for me. And Nicole is a math whiz. In fact, she was a mathlete. So here's the number, Nicole. If the bailout cost $25.1 million, and again, I'm going to use the term intervention because I do want to be fair. I don't want to offend our UAW guests either. If the intervention of 2009 ends up with a net cost of $25.1 million, and again, that's just with the loans and what was paid back, that's understanding, yes, there are other ways to measure. But if we look at $25.1 million lost net just on the loans, and we look at 2.6 million jobs saved, do the math here. How much per job? 2.6 million, 25.1 billion? You're on the clock for the math. Now let me look over here at Dan Maloney and say, why do you say 2.6 million jobs saved through the government intervention?
Right. The study that, again, I'm citing, the Center for Automotive Research study, talks about the intertwined supply chain.
Hold on 1 second, Dan, because I've got the study here, and it was published in just a couple of months ago, December 2013. So it's a fresh study.
Correct.
And the Center for Automotive Research is ostensibly nonpartisan. When you hear that term, some will say, but is it biased in favor of the automotive industry?
You know, their methodology is all laid out in that study, and it's available for all online.
Okay, yeah, and I haven't looked at that, but fair enough. And they're saying what?
So they say it ended up saving 2.6 million jobs in the U.S. economy. And, you know, I tend to agree. Again, we're using a lot of local suppliers just for our plant. We've been on the upward swing. And, you know, it's a roller coaster in the auto industry. Good years, bad years. And we're riding a wave right now. It's a good year. And we've been hiring. We're down to about 625 employees in our local plant. We're up over 900 right now and still sporadically hiring. And we're optimistic that, you know, one day we're going to get over 1,000 again. And employees direct. Now, we have a lot of equipment coming in our plant. Maris Industries, Petz and Raybould, Lexington Screw Machines. You know, there's just a ton of local vendors and suppliers to our plant. And again, in this study, they say it's about 10 to 1 for the auto industry. So for every one of us, 900 of us, there's 10 other people in the community, there's 9,000 jobs. So, again, money well spent.
What's the number here, Nicole? Do you have it for me? She's still working. That's all right, because, again, 2.6 million jobs, $25 billion net lost on the loans, and what does that weigh out to? I think it's like roughly $10,000 per job, but Dan, to your point earlier, that may be not a great way to measure it, only because if you do have 2.6 million jobs saved, those people are paying taxes. What would they be doing if they weren't paying taxes? How many would be on government assistance? So I accept that we're never going to know exactly. Mm-hmm. I also understand the conservative criticism that we've been trying to go over this hour, and we want to hear from you. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. But let's get away from just saying Detroit. As you mentioned, the impact is not just Detroit. What's the local impact of the government intervention, Dan?
Well, again, we talked about the hiring that we've done here. So it's about 325 new Social Security numbers, right, came into our plant, and new members for the UAW, as well as new salaried folks. And, you know, again, we're creating those world-class fuel systems, emission controls. A lot of people don't know this, but I gave you a copy of the magazine there. The car and truck of the year, the Chevy Corvette Stingray and the Chevy Silverado, we have fuel systems on both of those. And cylinder deactivation system. So when
there it is.
There you go.
For
beautiful.
For our cameras, right. There it is. Yeah.
So They're both getting rave reviews, and sales are pretty high right now on SUVs and trucks. It's a profitable vehicle for GM, and they're reinvesting that money locally. About $140 million have been invested in this plant over the last couple of years. And I'd say 80% of that money stayed local, again, in some of those suppliers and vendors we talked about.
Some of your conservative critics say that these companies got in trouble in 2006, 7, 8 and needed the intervention because of union costs. But there's also the concern that they just weren't making products that people wanted to buy. Do you think that we've got evidence now that that's changing? And let me ask Jerry, do you see a difference in the quality of the products over the last 5 years?
Our quality's up. We're making a lot better product now. You know, we make real strong strides towards better quality every day.
What do you think there, Dan? How would you assess the quality 5 years versus today?
Well, Jerry was at a disadvantage. I had some paperwork in front of me here. But J.D. Power Awards, right? GM had the most segment leaders in 2013 initial quality study, and that's from the consumers. So they had 8 vehicles, and that was a record for General Motors. 7 of those 8 vehicles have product that we make in Rochester on them, emission controls or fuel systems. Consumer Reports, right? They used to be very anti-American, just to be quite frank, right? They loved Japanese vehicles at one time. 16 models.
Well, they wouldn't say they were anti-American. They would say that America wasn't making a car as well as the Japanese were. That's what they would say.
All right, Evan, I'll go with that. 16.
I've heard them say it.
16 models on the recommended buy list for Consumer Reports. We talked about the car and truck of the year, the Corvette and the Silverado. Again, locally, we make products for them. Cadillac CTS, and here's one that everybody's proud of. Consumer Reports, best in class. The Impala, top full-size sedan, first time ever for General Motors to get that award. So as far as quality, some of these come from the consumer. Some of these come from the automotive writers. And it's quite an honor, again, that we are building top shelf, top quality vehicles.
Competing worldwide here. Let's get back to the phones. David in Rochester. Go ahead, David.
Yes, I want to get off on an order, and I'll take your answer offline. I challenge your credibility regarding the minimum wage hike. If you carefully look at about a four-year-old RAND study and later the Cato Institute, not particularly progressive think tank, and the CBO in the history of raising the minimum wage, while a few jobs may have been lost, by and large, there has not been the corporate threatened real people going to lose their jobs. That's just not the reality if you really carefully review those studies.
David, you're saying, and again, if you missed part of it, David is saying that Cato, the institute that we had invited onto the program today, because they've been critical of the auto bailout even still, the auto intervention even still, they could not join us today, and we had hoped to have them. But in a minute, I'll read some of their criticism. You're saying they've looked at minimum wage, and they found that there will be disruption in employment. Is that what you're saying, David?
And no, there will not be a significant as threatened by corporate America.
You're saying that there would not be?
There would not be. The RAND Institute has documented there isn't. And if you look at CBO, it's just primarily fiction. Fiction myth created to create a threat against voting for a minimum wage.
No, I take no position. I'm trying to learn as best I can from nonpartisan economists. A good example is Kent Gardner of the Center for Governmental Research in Rochester says there are plenty of good reasons to support an increase in the minimum wage if you accept that there could be some non-zero job loss, but it's hard to calculate. And the more sharp the increase, the more disruptive it would be. That's why a lot of people favor incremental increases. I don't take a position, and I'm open to all the data, and I'd be happy to see it. So, David, if you want to email me that Cato data, I'd love to see it. And you're absolutely right. They are much more conservative. And if what you're saying is accurate, they're saying that minimum wage would not be disruptive at certain levels to raise it. We ought to know about it. So, and I apologize for not in advance.
there would be a cost, but they said it would not be disruptive.
Okay, fair enough.
I can forward that to your station.
Please do. No, send it to me, edawson@wxxi.org. Do it, David, and I appreciate that. And thanks for calling the program. We're always here to learn here. We do not come in with preconceived notions. We want to do our best to broaden our minds. Let's get to Paul in Irondequoit. Thanks for calling, Paul.
Well, I'm glad to see the American car industry coming back. Don't get me wrong. I currently don't own any of them. I am looking at getting one of them.
Okay.
I noticed their prices are up quite a bit. But they're all up quite a bit, of course. But here's where I get into it with the auto manufacturers. It wasn't only the cars. They also ran a banking industry that they bankrupted. And then, you know, when they got the money, they invested it in China quite a bit. Okay? And there's another part of this that's never talked about either. There's a lot of regulations on automobiles. How many regulators lost their jobs? None of them. So the government was more or less forced to beef up the auto industry to keep the regulators working. And there was literally thousands and tens of thousands of people that work in regulating that industry.
You think the auto intervention was designed to help the government regulators?
Well, there's part of it that's being used for that right now. There's nothing on a car that's made that's not regulated anymore. Like, you can't just say, I want to install electric windows. It's all regulated. Regulators lost their jobs that were watching the assembly lines. When the assembly lines shut down, no regulators lost their jobs.
Well, we're going to have Dan respond to this in just a second, but I confess, Paul, I do not know how many auto regulators are employed by the government. I have never heard it be described as a government intervention designed to protect their jobs. But, Dan, how many people...
Well, the other side of the coin is the banking part of it.
Okay,
sure. Nobody ever talks about.
Okay, so let's let Dan Maloney from UAW, let's hit both of those points. Let's start with the regulators. How many regulators are there, Dan?
That we don't know, but okay. The National Highway Transportation Safety, I guess he's talking about, and whether those cars were foreign, nameplated, or domestic, right? They're going to be regulated. When they come over at the border, if they come off a slow boat from China and they're unloaded in California, right? They're going to make sure that the windshields are the right tensile strength and, you know, your tire treads are right. Right. So they're under the same regulations. It wouldn't matter who made them. So I don't think any regulators would be affected.
All right. Let's talk about the banking aspect he's talking about. He's talking about investing in
sure.
China as well. Go ahead.
Now, and that is a good investment, believe it or not. And I'm against expanding into China. Believe me, I want everything built in the USA. I want to expand my membership here, besides being a patriotic American, right? It's the right thing to do. But the business guys tell us from a financial aspect, China's growing by leaps and bounds. So they put a Buick factory over there, and they're building vehicles, and they're selling them, and they're making money. The place where we're losing money is Europe at this point. And GM's made that decision, publicly announced they're pulling out the Chevy nameplate out of Europe. So they are making adjustments, right? Our new CEO and her financial team reviewing everything and making all those adjustments. And again, the UAW, all we can do is in those negotiations every few years is ask for those products to be brought back home. We were successful in 2011, and we brought back some vehicles from Korea, Mexico, and Canada that are now being built in the U.S. So we'll continue down that path.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, I appreciate the answer, but I don't really understand how, you know, they finance cars. Okay, so here I am. I got the big mortgage. I'm going to lose the house. I'm going to lose the car because of the financial situation. And they make a loan for the auto manufacturers, and they get to cover their banking problems with it also. Now, I appreciate the UAW. I have a friend of mine that used to be the president over here at Vallejo. And you know, I support union activity and everything else. But we've transitioned from the old auto manufacturing to the new. And, you know, the regulators, like I say, they are running the whole show. And it's really, I think, forcing prices higher. I went and looked at the new Impala. And I think the new Impala that I was looking at was $38,000. And, you know, you're supposed to spend approximately 5 months of your wages on a new car and on whatever, you know, and have a nice down payment, like a third. That's the rule that I've always went by. And I'll tell you, they're getting way beyond, you know, affordability. But they also manufacture cars that are $20,000 that are nice cars, like the Chevy Cruze. That's a nice car.
All right, so I appreciate it, Paul, and thanks for the call. Go ahead, Dan. You want to address those points?
No, he made it for me, right? GM has a car pretty much in every segment now. Small, mid-size, full-size, trucks, SUVs, crossovers, and at every price point.
You have to, don't you?
Amen, right? But there was a long time where GM had abandoned the small car market
and
completely.
You got killed there.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I think the company got in so much trouble, wasn't it?
Absolutely. But we're back. We're strong. We got the Volt, the Sonic. We're back in the Cruze he mentioned. That thing's hot, and people love them. So, yeah, we'll keep the momentum going.
It's been 5 years since the government intervention in the auto industry, and we're taking a look at whether or not it was a good idea and how it has played out, especially after the big news peg from a couple of months ago when the government sold the remaining shares of GM. The government is out of the auto business there, and now we're looking at the jobs either gained or saved and the cost to taxpayers, and we're taking your questions. We've got Dan Maloney from UAW along with Jerry Burge, who are here in studio on this Wednesday afternoon. Go ahead, Mike in Rochester. Go right ahead.
Great, Evan. Thank you. Gentlemen, I just want to say I'm a very conservative person, but I think that the best thing that the government has ever done is support the American auto industry. I mean, manufacturing is the essence of our wealth creation in this country next to home building. And to even talk about the possibility of letting our car companies, for whatever reason, I know there is problems with unions, problems with management, but the fact is America needs a strong U.S.-based auto manufacturing center. And the situation with bailing out, quote-unquote, American auto manufacturers, one need only look at Mercedes-Benz, Toyota, et cetera. Many foreign European and Japanese auto manufacturers in the U.S. have received hundreds of millions of dollars of tax, basically tax benefits as well, welfare, corporate welfare, to help them manufacture. So it is not just American corporations that have received benefit from governmental agencies to help them prosper. And I'd just like your comments on that.
Well, thanks for the call. Mike, go ahead.
Yep, he's absolutely right. One thing that we've been dealing with, we deal with some of our partners, Coalition for a Prosperous America, Alliance for American Manufacturing, they talk about a VAT tax, value-added tax. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So everyone else pretty much in the industrialized world has that. So our cars going overseas, face this tariff. It's called a VAT, value-added tax. It gets hit when they unload off the ship, and then when they prep it at a dealer in Japan or China, it gets hit again through every stage until the final consumer pays it. So, and that's a tariff on our products used to subsidize their industries. Their vehicles coming over here don't face that same tax at all. So that's something we've been working on through our lobbying efforts, trying to get that changed. The currency manipulation's another one, right? China, you've seen it in the press lately, undervaluing those, dumping their products in the U.S. Again, they've just been stealing our intellectual property for years. We've been on the wrong end of these trade deals for far too long, and I think one of the callers mentioned that Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
We've been in strong opposition to that. And God bless our local Congresswoman Louise Slaughter on that one.
Well, I heard from her office this morning on that exact issue. Because
there you go.
They view the intervention in the auto industry today, 5 years later, more in terms of what happens next and what's going on with that trade deal, and they're very concerned about it.
As are we. If that were to go through, they call it NAFTA on steroids. So what we've seen, the presidential candidate in the 90s, the giant sucking sound for
Ross Perot,
going to Mexico, well, we'd see that, right, on steroids going to China. So, again, thank God for Louise and her staff fighting that every step of the way.
Let's get back to the phones. Ann in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Ann. Are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'd like to raise a larger issue, and I'll take your comments off the air. And I think it's apropos for Rochester. The federal government intervenes in the car industry because it's in trouble. right here we had a company called Kodak that was in trouble. Where is the slippery slope? What does the government come in and help, and what doesn't it come in and help? The Kodak that was is no longer. The amount of people who are employed here are no longer. What makes one industry okay to support as a federal government and another industry is ignored? Thanks for taking my call. Bye now.
Thanks very much. And frankly, Dan, that's exactly the concern that the economist expressed to me in the term moral hazard. Mm-hmm. That says, you know, if we're going to bail you out, are you not concerned about the way your business behaves? And how does the government choose winners and losers? So is that a fair complaint?
Yeah, you know, if you were a Kodak employee, and plenty of my friends and my father-in-law were, yeah. And it's a localized problem, though. It's within the Rochester community for the most part. I mean, at one time there were approximately 65,000 employees here in the Rochester area. And I guess last estimates, they're down under 4,000. So, yeah, losing 60,000 jobs is horrific. But losing 2.6 million jobs would have sent us into the Great Depression. That's the difference. This is really a nationalized industry, and the supply chain was so much broader and deeper in the auto industry than it was for Kodak. That was pretty much vertically integrated right here in Rochester. And again, I wish they could have kept it. A lot of friends and family members working there.
I think to Ann's broader point, I think that is going to be a big challenge for government going forward, because you've called this a model intervention. You said it works even better than you expected.
Yes.
But you don't want to get in the habit of having the government need to come in and save you, even if, as you say, it worked out well.
Right.
Do you?
No, lessons learned, right? And that's both on the corporate side. And again, like I said, now when we go into negotiations, those numbers are there. And in the past, there was, again, that adversarial relationship that no longer exists. We all want this company to do well for our mutual benefit, and we didn't want the government in there. When they were looking over our shoulders, there was a lot of things we could and couldn't do, right, as a union and as a company. And believe me, we're all happy to see the government out of our business.
We're talking to Dan Maloney and Jerry Burge from UAW. If you're just joining us on this Wednesday afternoon, we wanted to look at the U.S. auto intervention 5 years later, particularly in light of the fact that the U.S. recently sold the federal shares of GM and is now out of that business, which is probably a good thing for the stock price, because the stock price was having a trouble moving, and now it's sort of free of that stigma of the government intervention. So the question is, has this been a good intervention? And I'd like to read from some of what Cato has written about this. Cato, a conservative institute that still challenges the success of the U.S. auto intervention. They point out, number one, as we've been talking about the numbers, if you just joined us, it looks like the U.S., the federal government, will end up having a net loss of $25 billion in loans. $80 billion total loans to three companies, probably a net loss of about $25 billion. When I say a loss, that's those three companies not paying back all $80 billion. Now, Dan Maloney is making the point that, yes, those companies didn't pay back the $80 billion, but the employment success has provided taxes and other factors that nets that out. But the companies were $25 billion short, so that's going to be the loss there. And 2.6 million jobs saved is the estimate from the Center for Automotive Research. So here's what Cato writes about this. They write, quote, "The intervention on GM's behalf denied the spoils of competition, the market share, sales revenues, profits, and productive assets to Ford, Honda, Hyundai, and all of the other automakers that made better products, made better decisions, were more efficient, and were more responsive to consumer demands than GM, thereby short-circuiting a feedback loop that is essential to the healthy functioning of competitive market economies. Corporate bailouts are clearly unfair to taxpayers, but they are also unfair to the successful firms in the industry who are implicitly taxed and burdened when their competition is subsidized." He goes on to say, "It is not only fair but efficient and wise that the market rewards companies that make better products at better prices with higher profits and larger market shares, while the companies that make undesirable products at high cost lose profits and market shares. That must be the model going forward." Dan?
Again, I'm going to be a patriot here. And whoever wants to see our manufacturing base outsourced to China, we see China flexing the muscle out there in the Pacific Rim countries, right, with Japan in particular. And at some point, you know, they might get froggy, you want to leap. And how do we defend ourselves and our allies, right? If everything, tanks, planes, weapon systems are being built in China, right? So that's just in a patriotic standpoint, just a self-preservation standpoint. We need a strong manufacturing base here in the U.S. The other one is we've talked about all the unfair subsidies, all the corporate welfare, the banking industry. Nobody ever raised an eyebrow, I don't believe, from the Cato Institute about the gift to the banking industry and the major screw-up that they caused. And then the other point is Mullally, the CEO at Ford. Ford had been mortgaged up to its neck, right, just before the crash in 08. So they were sitting on a pile of cash. And like the story always says, they even mortgaged the Blue Oval from Ford. So you'll see these Ford guys saying they didn't need the government cheese.
Right.
It's not true. Had we went under, Ford was shaky, they would have went under, and so would have Toyota. Again, all of those foreign manufacturers would have went under because of that shared supply chain. And when that happened, it would have been a global depression. So I'm not sure if that report is quite accurate. I'll leave it at that.
We got about a minute left here. What is the state of the auto manufacturing industry in Rochester, and what do you expect going forward?
We've been converting folks over to permanent employment status from temporary. We've been growing. We're getting new equipment in from all our local vendor and suppliers. We're debugging that equipment. We're ramping up. We're building the engines for the truck and the car of the year. Sales are up with Chevy. Overall, profits are up. It's a smarter corporation, I believe. We've restructured all of our union agreements. And going forward, I think we're going to be here again. I have my children working in the plant now. I don't want to move them back home.
Would you be shocked if there's another call for or need for a government intervention?
I don't see it. Hopefully in my career at General Motors, I think it would have to be a real devastating economic debacle that had nothing to do with the auto industry. I think we're going to be solid for years to come.
You're probably glad to be moving past this conversation and looking at trade deals and other issues, I imagine, Dan. So.
Amen. We'd like to come back someday and talk about Automoon Wineries that Jerry Burge is CEO of.
There's a good plug for a friend. And we'll come back and we'll talk about the trade deals as well, because I know Congresswoman Slaughter is concerned about it. Others support it. We're going to talk about those issues in the future. For now, thanks for the conversation on the auto intervention. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Dan,
thanks for being here.
And thanks for all of our callers and comments on this hour of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great Wednesday afternoon. We'll see you right back here on a Thursday.